time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for February 16th, 2019. A belated happy Valentine's Day, everyone. We're halfway through February to my psychological beginning of spring, March 1st. Pitchers and catchers have already reported to spring training. Life is good. Speaking of good, it would be really good for WJCU if you took a few minutes and pledged your support during these last 2 days of Radiothon 2019. We're running along toward our 50K goal of $50,000, and every little bit counts. Remember that all the proceeds of Radiothon stay right here at the station. We have some plans to bring our studio into the 21st century by adding some chairs in the lobby and a fresh paint job and some real mailboxes for the DJs. And that's just one little project. Radiothon proceeds also help to sustain us throughout the year. It's the only fundraising we do. So log on to www.wjcu.org, click the pledge button, and the Easiest Pie form will pop right up. Donations of over $25 carry some pretty sweet tokens of our appreciation, too. If you want to call the station and talk with a real live person, you can dial 216-397-4438. We are standing by. Radiothon ends tomorrow, Sunday night, February 17th at midnight. Then the online form turns into a pumpkin, so don't hesitate. Log on now or call 216-397-4438. And thanks for your support. Well, alrighty then, this week's show. I think you're going to like it. Earlier this week, or maybe it was late last week, Rails to Trails announced the Great American Bike Trail, a coast-to-coast, not on the road, but on the paths trail. It will travel through 12 key states. It'll begin in D.C. and end up in Washington State. Rails to Trails is going to have a big reveal in May about the route. I wanted to know more. So Kevin Mills, who's the Senior VP for Policy at Rails to Trails, joins me to fill us in on the trail and what it's going to take to complete it. After a break, where we will probably mention Radiothon once again, we're going to head to PA to speak with elite pro racer, coach, race announcer, and probably one of the nicest guys in our sport, Bill Elliston. In an interview Bill did with Peter Flax in 2017, and by the way, the interview is excellent. You can find it at cyclingtips.com under the title The Lifer, The Extraordinary Story of a Somewhat Ordinary Bike Racer. Peter says, in the long years between his first contract and his retirement, Ellison came to discover his role in the domestic pro peloton as a gifted workhorse, the kind of guy who helps other people win bike races, a rider with the diesel engine and the tactical mind, and especially the selfless attitude to put a teammate in the position to post up at the finish line. In our conversation, you'll hear Bill's passion for the sport and his perspective on how it has affected his life. You're going to love this guy. So let's head on down to Washington, D.C., and talk with Kevin Mills about the Rails to Trails Great American Bike Route. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thanks, Diane. Glad to be here.
My pleasure. So recently, Rails to Trails announced the Great American Rail Trail. And I shared it with my listeners, both by Facebook and Twitter and whatever else I use. I don't know. There's a lot of interest in this idea. Tell us about the genesis of the idea for a seamless cross-country rail trail.
Well, our co-founder, David Burwell, had the idea of building a cross-country rail trail back around the time that Rails Trails Conservancy started in 1986. He envisioned the trail to become America's main street, a route that would be free of car traffic, with a gentle grade, and accessible to everyone regardless of their age or ability. But It turns out that the idea was a bit before its time. Basically, our first pursuit as an organization needed to be to empower trail champions across the country to build trails on what was then tens of thousands of miles of former rail corridor that weren't being used. And so, with those trails on the ground, we then were able to set out to build a rich regional trail networks connecting all those different trails to each other and to the communities they serve. And so we were doing that all over the country. And now, we're able to turn our attention to building a spine between those communities and across the country that's going to weave all of that together into a nationwide network of trails. So essentially, this has been a vision with the organization for a long time, all along throughout our history. But we're now seeing the situation ripen to the point where we feel, this will be successful and deeply impactful on the country. And what we did is a couple of years ago saw an opportunity to, we looked at how we were doing with existing trails for this route, and we found there was a viable route across the country that was about half done, and that was a bit of a trigger for us.
Wow, half done. So I can remember years and years ago when one of my clients came to me and said, I just rode this really cool thing. It's called the Katy Trail.
Mm-hmm.
I know that was way back in the early 90s, late 80s sometimes, because I can sort of envision him coming in and talking to me about this. So it's really cool that here we are 30 some odd years later and this whole idea is coming together, which, by the way, it sounds like a really long period of time. But when you look at the way things unfold, 33 years maybe isn't as long as all that to be able to be talking about this final idea of getting a point-to-point cross-country trail. So what are the next steps? What's going to happen now?
Right, yeah. So the idea is, as I said, it's about half done, and it is a process of knitting together existing trails and then filling in the gaps. The idea is to get from Washington, D.C. to at least Seattle, Washington, and then our friends in Washington State could make a decision along the way of whether they want to extend that to the ocean. What we're looking forward to here is in May, we're going to have a route launch where we'll announce the cross-country route. We've already made clear which states it will go through and revealed gateway trails, but we are doing work with our partners on the ground, working with more than 125 existing trails and working with our state partners to essentially nail down the route. And we're going to have a reveal announcement in May on the anniversary, the 150th anniversary of the Golden Spike that marked the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. So we're really looking forward to that. And then we're busy with a whole bunch of different pieces that need to come together to make this happen. Assessing the needs for trails along the route, how do you prioritize gaps to address and sequence those, pursuing funding opportunities for the trail building, with some things ripening at this point in Iowa and Washington along those lines, working with our states on their trail plans and making sure the political will is there to do their part and that they've structured themselves to pursue it. And then on the communications end, making sure that there's visibility and public support for this venture.
Yeah, it sounds like such a cool thing. I would do it. I know people who are saying, oh, I'm lining up for that, but this is not going to happen overnight. What are some of the bigger gaps in the trail right now? Where are the places where you think it's going to be most, I don't want to use the word difficult, but what might take the longest to knit together?
Well, we're definitely aware, just in terms of mileage, that the largest gaps are in Wyoming and Montana.
Yeah, sure.
And it has the additional challenge of getting over the Continental Divide, right? But that's one of the virtues of rail trails is the locomotives don't like a steep grade, and so if you really want to have this trail that's accessible for all ages and abilities, you're going to want to think about rail corridors as a way to crack that nut, if you will. We're also fortunate, though, to have some very good partners in Wyoming and Montana who've already taken steps to ensconce this idea in their state trail plan, that they have met with us and explored the potential routes through their states and have come to a level of agreement about priorities of where to go. and the wonderful opportunities that that taking those routes will create in terms of things like rural economic development. So we're optimistic, but it is certainly a challenging undertaking. There's also another challenge where we feel like we're already getting traction is in Nebraska, where the state has recently made a commitment to invest in filling in the gaps in the Cowboy Trail, which is a wonderful long distance trail. And then, of course, there's needs to be a match to federal dollars used for that. And we've had some success in finding a generous donor who wanted to be part of that. So we have traction, but we certainly have challenges.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kevin Mills. He is the Senior Vice President of Policy for Rails to Trails. So you mentioned federal dollars, you mentioned grants and matching dollars. Money is always part of the equation. Given the current state of the country and the way it's not doing anything for infrastructure, I know Rails to Trails always depended on some government funding. What do you see going forward as some of the positive things with funding? You did get, I just heard you say, a matching donor, which is really cool. But what is it matching to?
Sure. So I think to get this done, it will take a combination of federal, state, local, and private investment. And we think with the excitement around it that's within reach over time. Definitely are looking to, you know, that combination of everybody pulling together, because this is going to be a really significant asset for the country, something that, you know, will really be iconic and that people can be proud of and have a legacy. And so, you know, that is part of our challenge is mustering the political will to do that. As you mentioned about infrastructure, it has been hard of late to get to the finish line with infrastructure ideas, but we are fortunate that it is one of the issues that really unites people, you know, across parties and philosophies and what have you. There's a bit of a, as compared to other issues, a bit of a societal consensus that it's important to invest in infrastructure and that it can provide a lot of leverage and benefits for the country.
Well, I think when we look at trails that run through specific communities or even alongside communities, that you see an economic boost wherever they're built. So people, you know, either open restaurants or maybe bed and breakfasts, or just if it runs through an urban area, the businesses along that way benefit. So, and also building trails puts people to work. So I guess I don't see a lot of a downside to doing it. Is there a projected finish date?
Well, so as I said, it's already half done, and those trails are available to explore now. We also can expect that more will be coming online year after year, but this is absolutely a long-term venture. Full completion of the route is likely to take decades, but we will venture to empower trail users to use the trail both within their regions and for epic long-distance trips well before every piece of infrastructure is in place.
So what's the next thing that's going to happen?
Well, so we're looking forward to that May route reveal and working with our partners in all the states along the route to move the project forward. We also need to build public support to sustain the project throughout the process. You know, your listeners and our members writ large are going to be crucial to sustaining an effort that's going to take this long.
And how would they do that? How can they get involved?
Well, I think the easiest thing would be for them to go to our website, railsthetrails.org/Great American Rail Trail, and they could go there and choose the Get Updates button to stay plugged into the evolving opportunities to get involved and help. We're also a membership organization, so it would also help to have your listeners join Rails to Trails Conservancy.
Well, this is exciting. We are looking forward to trying the Cumberland Trail this year ourselves. And I know there is a specific trail that I'm interested. Maybe you can give me an update on it real quick. And that's one in the Adirondacks where they're going to remove some railroad tracks and put a trail in. Is that happening?
You know, I haven't heard what is the latest on that project, but I'm certainly familiar with it from prior years. So I would probably need to go back to the team and see what they've heard lately. But I'm definitely familiar with that. And it's a beautiful country. I was up there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we have family there. So it's always fun to find out good things that are happening. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for telling us about the Great American Rail Trail. Once again, Kevin Mills, Rails to Trails. You can go to railstotrails.org if you're interested and find out all about it. We'll keep watching. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks, Dan.
All right. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kevin Mills joined me from the offices of Rails to Trails in Washington, D.C. If you would like to become a member of the organization, learn more about the Great American Bike Trail, or become involved in any way, you can log on to railstotrails.org. Kevin Mills joined me from the offices of Rails to Trails in Washington, D.C. If you would like to become a member of the organization, learn more about the Great American Bike Trail, or become involved in any way, you can log on to railstotrails.org. We're going to take a break for a station ID, and while we're away, how about logging on to your computer, typing in wjcu.org, and pledging your support for Radiothon 2019? We'll be back in a flash. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back, and I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Did you call the station and make your pledge? If you didn't, the number is still 216-397-4438, or you can still log on to wjcu.org. There's time between now and tomorrow at midnight when Radiothon officially comes to an end. So you know how you meet someone and start talking, and it's sort of like you've known them a long time, like an old friend? That's what my conversation with bike racer and coach Bill Elliston is like. He's just got this incredibly mild manner, and yet we know he can just kill it on a bike. Listen in. Hi, Bill. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Pleasure. Thanks for bringing me into this.
I have a big network of people who feed me information. And when they say, you need to have a conversation with somebody, I go and look it up because usually they're right. And so I decided to contact you out of some of that conversation that came up. And I recently read a long story about you. So, you know, I have to do due diligence before I bring somebody on the show. So I do some research. And Peter Flax, who has been on my show several times, wrote a great story about you in Cycling Tips back in December of 2017. And the thing that really interested me was the point of the story, which is really cool, is about you being a lifer. How would you describe that? What does that mean, a lifer?
You know, I just, so to backtrack a little, that comment came up with Peter. I've known Peter a long time, and the comment came up during the course of an interview when a longtime cycling icon, Steve Tilford, had passed away maybe a year and a half ago.
Right, right.
Peter reached out to interview a bunch of us that had been longtime friends and competitors and so on with Steve. And one of the kind of seemingly offhand comments I made during that interview was just that I had admired Steve so much because he had been a bit of a lifer in the sport in terms of it was something he had done his entire life. And he had collected basically every paycheck he had ever collected had been in some form or another from the sport of bikes and bike racing. And I had just commented how I really admired that. And I kind of felt that I had fallen into that same mold as I kind of grew up a little bit, so to speak.
Well, as I read the story, I would agree. You did fall into that mold. You, in fact, are a lifer. And you have such sort of an altruistic way of being in the sport. So let's talk, back up a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about your early days. I did read that life at home wasn't so great. How did the bike change things for you? What did you get out of riding a bike and then suddenly racing a bike?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the bike that really provided me at that point was just a sense of freedom. Life was definitely a little bit chaotic at home. It wasn't horrifying by any standards, but it was certainly a little chaotic and a little uncomfortable when I was, you know, kind of getting into my early teens, I suppose. And the bike just offered me a way to get a little bit of distance from that and gain a little clarity in my head and burn off some excess energy that otherwise might have gone to other no good activities.
Hmm. True that. So what was your first bike? Do you remember? Of course you do.
Yeah, of course. Everybody, I think everybody remembers that, right? My first bike, my folks actually bought me when I was probably, I want to say 12 or 13 years old. And it was a red Concord from one of the local big bike shops in town here. That's interestingly enough, still in business and doing quite well. And I bought it with the idea of delivering newspapers and that sort of stuff. So I bought the bike and very quickly my folks bought some baskets for it so I could haul my newspapers on my newspaper route. So it wasn't necessarily a high-end bike, but it was, I want to say it was a relatively modern racing style 10-speed. But it was dark red with gold and black lettering. And I don't remember the parts that were on it, unfortunately, at this point, but it was a great bike and it certainly enabled me to deliver the papers plus some, plus get out in the countryside and really kind of explore things a little bit.
Well, it's interesting that you say Concord because the Concords were distributed by a company in Columbus, Ohio called Columbus Cycle. And I can remember when Concords used to come into our shop many, many, many years ago, and they were nice Japanese bikes. They were actually made in Japan. They were not made in China. So they were nice. And by today's standards, they'd be really nice, I would think.
Yeah, it's funny. I've actually looked for some on eBay and so on, or some of the old steel enthusiast groups on Facebook's tried to find one, but I've never been able to track one down, which is kind of unfortunate. But that's kind of an interesting fact that they were brought in through an Ohio-based company. I did not know that.
Yeah, so there you go. I got to teach you a little something today, although you could probably teach me a lot about cycling.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, we'll find out as we move along here. You've been racing at high levels for over 30 years. You've seen a lot of things happen. You've seen a lot of things change in the sport. And you're one of those people who chose no doping for me. And you had that opportunity and turned it down. So, you know, I always wonder, people like Tyler Hamilton and Lance Armstrong and all those guys took the other route. And do you think more people than just you were affected? I mean, obviously, it did something to your career. It short-circuited it in a way because you didn't dope. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, doping certainly had a pretty widespread effect. And I think a lot of people on the outside of the sport or really with just a little bit of passing knowledge about racing and so on, don't necessarily understand the scope of the doping and how deep-rooted it's gone and how it really did have a pretty widespread effect. And do I think it affected me? Yeah, I think it affected me a fair bit. I try not to get hung up on it a whole lot, and I try not to think about it a whole lot in terms of what could have been or what should have been or whatever. At the end of the day, I just have to stand by my decision as having made the decision not to do it. I mean, when I was really coming up in the late 80s, doping wasn't quite as prevalent. There was certainly some guys doing some what would probably be called minor drugs at this point, like amphetamine type stuff and steroids. I think that stuff was relatively common among the elite riders. I, at that point, had no inkling of that. I was actually pretty naive at that age, and even really up until the mid 90s, I was pretty naive to any of that stuff. And it wasn't until I ended up on some teams where there was some guys that were maybe a little bit suspicious or other riders were kind of talking about that I realized exactly how widespread it was and how rooted it had become. And I just had, you know, I had mentioned to Peter in my article, the quote opportunity for me to take that plunge didn't come until really probably a little on the later side of my career. And at that point, it would have been pretty silly for me to go down that road. had that chance come a little earlier, I want to say I would have said no, but it's hard to go back in time to your younger self when you're in your mid-20s and you're scraping by trying to live off prize money and have that put in front of you and say, and for me to say now that no, I wouldn't have done it, that's not really an answer I can clearly say. But all I know is at the end of the day, I didn't do it.
Right.
And I'm pretty happy with that fact. And I sleep well at night. And guys that did it, it's their choice. They have to live with it the rest of their lives. And that's that. So, I mean, I'm okay with it. There's certainly days when I think about it. And, you know, you think about how much you might have scraped to get by, or how, you know, maybe you get out a bigger house or a nicer car or a bigger financial safety net to fall back on. And a lot of those guys I know from that period gained a lot of those things by doping. So once in a while, I think about that and it bothers me a little bit, but it's kind of a microcosm of life. You can't get too caught up in it. You just have to live with your own decisions and trudge forward.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Bill Elliston. He is pro. I'm going to still call you a pro. He's been racing for a long, long time. He's a coach. He's a race announcer. He does a whole bunch of stuff. We'll talk about all of his different little hats in a little while. I'm still kind of interested in this career that you're really still part of that scene. I mean, you know all of the cyclocross people, you know all, actually, you know everybody in the sport still. When you look back over your career, is there an incident or an event that just changed your life irrevocably, besides the fact that you turned down whatever the offer was about doping?
You know, that's a tough one, actually. There's so many incidents or events that changed my life in a lot of different ways that it's hard to pinpoint one. But I think if I really had to pinpoint one, I would go back just a little over 20 years and just kind of an innocuous fall day when I was out for a training ride. My wife and I were supposed to go on vacation the next day or within a couple of days, and just out for a little bit of a training ride, and literally 3 miles from home, had a squirrel or some sort run out in front of me, get caught in my wheel, and it caused me to crash. And I crashed pretty spectacularly and ended up fracturing my skull and a lot of other little injuries that go with that. And that made me really kind of step back and assess my cycling life, my life outside of the bike with my wife and things like that, and made me put a lot of that stuff in perspective and figure out, because that at that point I was kind of in limbo with cycling. I'd already raced for a few years through the mid to early 90s professionally, and I 97 was my last year at that point racing professionally, kind of doing it independently when you could do that at that point without a team or anything like that. And I hadn't had a great year. I was negotiating. I was talking to a few teams for jobs the following year, but nothing was looking really good. And then I ended up with this accident and fractured skull and off the bike for a couple months and some permanent hearing loss. And it made me really kind of reevaluate some stuff. And initially I was like, man, I'm just going to walk away from the bike and stop racing. And this is silly. But the longer I was laid up, the more I realized I wanted to keep racing. And I did inevitably go through a period of not really racing quite as much, still racing a fair bit, but maybe not as much, and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life before I really circled back to bikes full time again. So that's probably the most defining incident I had. Because I think that's really the point where I realized shortly after that, you know, I don't really want to work outside of bikes. I don't want to do anything outside of bikes. So I'm going to do what I can to stay involved in the sport somehow and ride it out literally as an athlete, and then do whatever I can within the industry to keep that connection.
And you do. You have yeah, lots of connections still, and you're still doing a lot of really, really cool things. So is there a race that you look back on and say, wow, this is really what it was all about for me? This is why I got on the bike and wanted to go fast and wanted to race. And what if there was a race like that, what was it?
I think it's funny. I think about that one a lot too. And there's a lot of so many races that have some sort of special meaning to me. But I think really for me, probably 2007, the Philly International Classic, which originally started as the Core States U.S. Pro Championship and went through a number of iterations of title sponsors through the years and so on. And 2007, I was riding with Rite Aid Professional Cycling, which was one of PA's only pro teams at the time. We were a little bit of the bad news bears of the pro peloton. We were kind of a handful of misfits, some really talented bike riders that maybe were on the way up and hadn't kind of proven themselves yet, or some guys that were kind of in the twilight of their career and just trying to keep racing one more year before they really figured out what they were going to do with themselves. And we didn't have a ton of organization. We didn't have a ton of financial backing. We didn't have a ton of status or presence in the professional peloton. But that year we were able to bring on a couple of Argentinian riders who, one of them, Alejandro Barajo, turned out to be just an absolute diamond. He had spent some time in Europe, decided he didn't like that lifestyle, came over here to race, and ended up on Rite Aid for 2007. And early in the season, we realized he was really a legit bike rider, could get in the top three or five or win just about any race domestically here. So we went into the Philly race knowing that we actually had a rider that could get on the podium. So at some point during that race, a pretty big breakaway went up the road, maybe 12, 15 guys, and we had missed the break. I had been back sidelined by a flat, so getting a wheel change, kind of chasing back through the peloton. And as I'm coming through the back of the field, I hear in my radio earpiece that there was a break up the road and we had nobody in it. So as soon as I catch the back of the field, kind of make my way up to the front, collect a bunch of the teammates on the way. And we got up to the front with Barajo sitting probably fifth, sixth wheel behind us. And this little scrappy team from Philadelphia spent probably three, four laps on the front of the race, just rotating with one other team to bring that break back and give our riders a chance. And we were able to do it. But to me, that was really the race, because I had grown up watching the U.S. Pro Championships in Philly. I remember going down to Philly in 1985 to watch the first ever edition of that race when Eric Heiden won. I went down there subsequent years and watched it. And if I wasn't there, I watched every other edition on TV. And if you grew up in the 80s and the early 90s racing your bike in the Northeast, Philly was kind of the pinnacle of the races that you wanted to do. That's what so many of us aspired to do. So that year was my third or fourth time doing the race, but that was finally the year that I actually got to play a bit of a role in a race that meant so much to me from being a 14-year-old.
That's so cool. I mean, I remember those races, even though living in Cleveland, I never actually got to Philly, but we followed that. And it never occurs to me that the riders have these, you know, sort of different views of those events. You know, they come to the race, they get on the start line, the gun goes off, and you know in those days, you were saying, I heard you say race radio, and before that there weren't even race radios. So the fact that you were able to get that information and move up, it's just so interesting how these races actually work. And I'd hate to use the word mechanically, you know, how they actually unfold. And we don't see that. We don't see it from that perspective.
Yeah, race radios are certainly an interesting thing. And they've obviously been a polarizing topic for a number of years, with being used for a while and then being banned. And to be honest, I don't even know what the current status is on it now. I don't follow it that much. I was never necessarily a huge fan of it. They certainly helped it at times, but I definitely prefer the kind of older school way of just really every rider having to pay attention and really see what's unfolding and figure it out on their own, rather than having every single detail barked into their ear.
Right, exactly. I know exactly what you mean. It's like, all right, too much information.
Yeah, some of the teams I rode for, we've had some directors that were overly chatty and perhaps overly demanding into the radio, so we would just pull the earpiece out and let him drop. When he would quiz us after the race, just be like, it was staticky. I pulled it out.
He used to get
so sick of hearing all this stuff.
you're still racing today, from what I can gather.
I am.
You can still kick most people's asses, from what I can gather. So what I want to ask you about is being an older rider and what a younger rider needs to learn that can keep them racing for the just sheer number of years that you've been out there at this sort of elite level.
Well, first, I wouldn't say I'm kicking asses too much occasionally. And if I do, there's certainly a little bit of luck involved. I don't know. I think that the biggest thing you really have to have is you have to have a very deep appreciation for the sport and a deep passion for the sport, because it's everybody that's raced a bike pretty much at any level, whether it's beginner or whether they've kind of gone up through the ranks to a professional rider. Everybody quickly sees how difficult it is on every level. It's very time consuming. It's a strain on time. It's a strain on money. It can be a strain on relationships. And it's painful. Training is hard. Racing is hard. There's moments where you walk away from races practically in tears because it's just so physically challenging. So you have to really be able to see through a lot of that and see the pure, simple enjoyment of racing a bike, first of all. And then really, I think, you know, one of the reasons that I can still do reasonably well in some races at this point is you have to really have a good understanding of what your strengths are and maybe more so what your weaknesses are. And you have to do what you can to work within that and be patient and look for the right opportunity that fits your skill set. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I can still do well is, to be honest, I don't do too many races that I know I'm not going to do well in. Like, I won't do a lot of super, super high level races. Like, I don't do too many of the NRC level races anymore. Maybe a few that have courses that suit me. I will generally try and go to Rochester, New York for that race because I can usually do okay. Generally, I'll have some reasonable luck in some high level criterions, but I don't go to too many of the bigger road races anymore. And I certainly don't go to any of the stage races anymore because I just know that where I'm at in life, I just don't have the time to train and I don't have the ability to contend in those races anymore. So it's kind of really, really understanding where you're at and what you're good at is a big key.
We're going to take a short break. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Okay. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the work you're doing now. I'm talking with Bill Elliston. He's a coach. He's a pro. He is a kick-ass rider. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we're back. And if you are just joining me, I've been speaking with Bill Elliston. He is a pro, a coach, a race announcer. He does all kinds of things. And if you didn't hear the first half of our interview, rewind, because I think it's interesting. Actually, I know it's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your coaching work. Elliston Coaching Services is pretty broad. You do a lot of different things, but I want to talk about basically your clients. When you take on a new client, what are the things you work on with him or her? What are the first things you look at?
Well, I think it really depends on where the client is coming from. When clients come to me and are interested in my coaching services, I really prefer to have kind of a long sit down face to face interview process with them to really kind of mine as much info out of them as I can to figure out what their history is, figure out where they're coming from, what they've been doing, what their goals are, so on and so forth, so I can really maybe kind of identify whether I can legitimately help these people. There has to be a very good relationship for a coach and a client to work effectively together. And sometimes it just doesn't mesh up real well. So I like to have the interview process and really figure out what this client needs. And in terms of how I help these folks or how I work with the clients, it really depends on what their issues are or where they're looking to go in the sport. So there's a million different things really that are involved in coaching in terms of the actual writing of the training plans, timing of bringing in certain different workouts, peaking for races, so on and so forth. So a lot of times you'll identify maybe just one problem with somebody. A lot of times you'll identify 3, 4, 5 problems with somebody. So it really, you really have to kind of figure out where the issues are. Because with a lot of people I've found, they've got the tools in place, they're just not using them properly. So it's a matter of figuring out how to instruct them to use their tools properly to get them where they want to go. So it's really a little bit of a different approach with everybody. So it's certainly far from a cookie cutter approach.
Do you work with young people as well as, say, you know, adults 20 to 40 and older? Do you ever work with some youngsters?
I do. I used to work with juniors under 18 riders a little bit more than I do now. Back probably about 8, 7, 8, maybe 9 years ago, myself and a good friend of mine ran an elite level junior team for a number of years, where we worked with 6, 7, 8 junior athletes, both men and women. And since then, I still take a team of junior riders to a pretty prestigious race in Canada every year. But outside of that, I really only work, I maintain generally about 25 clients on my list. And I would say maybe 3, 4 of those are juniors. So I don't work with as many as I used to. Part of that is I don't see as many juniors coming into the sport. And part of that is there can often be some issues with working with juniors that I've run into. A lot of times parenting has kind of changed in this day and age, and you've got a lot of hover. Yeah, right. And I don't have kids, so this is what I see.
Yeah, no kidding.
But a lot of parents tend to maybe be a little bit over involved with some of what their kids are doing. So I've had some issues in the past with trying to coach some juniors, but I end up almost never talking to the juniors. All my correspondence comes from the parents because they don't really give their kids any kind of a leash to have that relationship and to really blossom.
That's too bad.
It is. And I have a little bit of a problem with it, and I've called some parents out on it before. And so nowadays I'm very, very cautious with some of the juniors I work with, and the ones I work with when I, just like the adult clients that come to me, we go through an interview process, and I go through that process with one or both of their parents present. And I make it abundantly clear during that interview that my coaching relationship is with the athlete. I try and keep the parents informed of what's going on and up to speed and in the loop and all that. But I don't like to send an email to the client and have a reply come from the parent.
Right.
And just that started to happen a little too much. So now I'm very cautious about how I select junior athletes to work with and try and keep myself from having those kind of issues. And then I do still run my junior team to Canada every year for a pretty big stage race. But really the bulk of my clients are probably what a lot of coaching businesses are, in that they're really the middle-aged, kind of the master's riders or the category 3 level type of riders, men and women. I don't have too many, I've got a handful of professional level clients, but not a lot. But it's really just a lot of the weekend warrior types.
How important do you think bike fit is?
Bike fit's very important. I think for any athlete, you're spending a lot of time on this bike. So if it's not comfortable, you're simply not going to achieve the results you want. It's going to affect your efficiency, it's going to affect aerodynamics, and ultimately that's going to affect your performance. So I think bike fit's really critical, because when you're out there training and racing, the way to get the best out of the bike is for it to simply feel like an extension of yourself. And for it to feel like that, it needs to be fit really pretty specifically to you.
Yeah. Well, I'm a bike fitter, so I love hearing that.
There you go.
That's what matters, I think, you know, comfort, efficiency, performance. It kind of goes in that order. So you're offering kind of an interesting training camp in Belize.
Yes.
And you're doing it in March. So it's like, oh, let's get out of the Northeast in March. Tell us about the camp. Why did you choose Belize, and what's going to happen when you're there?
So I chose Belize. I've been going down to Belize since 2005. I originally started going for big one-day bike race they have over the Easter weekend. And I've gone back there. I've been back, I guess, probably about 12 times at this point, mostly all for racing. I've been back for I actually got brought in with another coach for a U.S. State Department appointed gig to help their federation down there learn a little bit about some coaching techniques and to help some of their athletes understand some principles of racing and training a little bit more. And I've been down there for I've run a couple other camps down there in the past few years. So it's kind of become a little bit of a home away from home for me. It's the first time I went down, I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't know a whole lot about Belize, which I think is really the case with a lot of people when they first hear about it. But when I went, I was pretty stunned to see what a great little country it is. It's very easy to assimilate into for Americans. They speak English. You don't need to exchange any currency. It's very American feeling in most of the cities and the towns down there. So it's really easy to assimilate in. And they've got a pretty good little bike racing and bike riding culture down there. For a small country, they'll routinely have 80-100 people show up for one of their big races.
Wow.
Yeah, so the more I went down there, the more I really continued to see the possibilities of what you could do down there in terms of racing and running some camps. And I had run some private teams camps for a women's team out of Chicago for a number of years. And every year we would kind of rotate the location around for something different. And probably about 4 years ago, we went down to Belize. And that was really the first camp I ran down there. And I think it was a resounding success. Everybody really loved it down there. We had some great rides. We went on some great adventures and saw a lot of the culture down there, going into the jungle and seeing some Mayan ruins and just getting some great training in some pretty phenomenal weather for this time of the year. So it's really held a place in my heart to keep going back and visiting and taking people down there to see what it has to offer, to see how great it is, how it's so easy to get to. And it's very, very much of a cheap vacation spot. So super simple.
How many people can you take?
This camp I'm doing 8.
Well, that's not a lot.
No, it's actually pretty small, to be honest, but I kept it cap pretty small just from a logistics point of view. Yeah. with doing a lot of, so all of our, we're not staying in one central location. It's all going to be point to point ride so that we get to see a lot of the country in one. So it's 7 days. We're going to do 5 rides that take us to all different regions of the country. So I had to arrange a follow vehicle and a mechanic and some ride assistance down there. So just trying to figure out all the logistics, kind of settled on 8 being pretty controllable number. I think if I got more than that, I would have to reevaluate some of the logistics and bring in some more folks and so on. So I think for the first big camp that I'm pulling off down there, 8 seemed to be the logical number.
Yeah. Is it filled?
Just about a couple more spots. Still got a few more weeks yet, but a couple more spots to fill up, but I'm looking forward to it.
What's the elevation down there?
The elevation is basically sea level.
Oh, cool. I could do
that. Yeah, that's kind of one of the things I looked for running a camp. One of the other camps I ran for the women's team was out of Encinitas, California, which was great. A lot of good riding along.
Right.
The coast.
Oh, I love it there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. I hadn't spent much time there until then. And there's also a lot of good riding when you go inland. But part of the problem when you go inland is you get into some of the bigger mountains,
right,
which is some great riding, but the terrain then becomes a little bit of a dictator of the rides, and it splits things up a little bit, and it becomes a little bit hard from a management perspective to kind of keep everything under control. So that was one of the things I liked about Belize is there are a few roads down there that are rolling to hilly. So we'll spend a few days on those roads, but most of the roads are relatively flat to maybe mildly rolling. So it makes it a little bit easier for a wider range of abilities to participate in the same camp. Because if you've got some people that are a little bit stronger than others, they can simply sit on the front of the group ride and maybe pull a little bit longer. And conversely, for some of the people that might maybe aren't quite as strong, they can just sit on the wheel, follow the draft, and not really have to expend as much energy and be able to survive these kind of rides, where if it was on hillier terrain, then the disparity of fitness becomes a little more evident for riders. And it can sometimes take the fun out of a camp when you have certain people constantly going away off the front of the group and maybe getting to rest stops or to the end of the ride a little bit sooner. And then you've got some other folks lagging behind a little bit. So I think I wanted to try and equalize things a little bit. And I think the roads down there with their terrain really helped do that.
So one of the things I got from reading Peter Flack's article about you was how unbelievably magnanimous you are about sharing your experience and advice and just information with others, whether they're paying clients or not. So I'm going to bug you for one piece of advice. If you were to give one piece of advice to someone who wants to improve his or her performance on the bike, what would it be? I know that's a hard one, right?
It is. It is. It is a hard one, really. I think what I would say to somebody is to really step outside yourself and take a very, very objective view of your strengths, but maybe more so your weaknesses, and work on your weaknesses. That's one of the cardinal rules of training is, you know, the old saying goes is race your strength, but train your weaknesses. And I think a lot of people get caught up in, you know, maybe they're a good sprinter, so that's all they do is train for sprinting. Right. And they really kind of forget that, well, you're going to need some other aspects just to get to that sprint. And they kind of forget to train that stuff. So I think to me, that would be the biggest piece of advice I would tell somebody is objectively figure out what your weaker spots are and spend a little more time than you do working on them to try and make yourself a little bit more of a well-rounded racer.
I think that's an outstanding free piece of advice, folks. And it is free. All right. So I only have a couple more things before I ask you my regular three questions. Of all the things you do, and you offer the clinics, you do seminars, you do race announcing, you're a coach, you're a rider still. What's the most satisfying thing you do?
That's another tough one, because everything I do, I really enjoy immensely, and I enjoy the variety. Doing just one aspect of any of that stuff would get a little bit difficult. So, oh man, I think what my favorite thing would be is working with some clients in races. For instance, I've got a younger guy I coach. I started coaching him actually when he was a junior, and he's now, I think, in his junior year of college at this point. And he was like a year ago, he was looking for a team to ride for. So I brought him onto the team I ride with back here in Pennsylvania. And so we get him into some races, and he's still kind of on the learning curve a little bit, as kind of every bike racer really is. So one of the things I really enjoy with him is in race, being able to point out to him ways that he can be more effective and watching him kind of capitalize that and get some good results out of that. And we had a few instances last year where he was just kind of running into some walls of trying to get results, but he and I would get in some races together. And I'd be like, no, follow me, do this. Look, watch these guys and you'll see why I'm doing what I'm doing, and give him some ideals and some rules to follow. And watching him literally ride that out to some success in those races was really satisfying. So things like that are probably the most satisfying, because you can give somebody a piece of guidance or a piece of advice and watch them put it into action and watch them get the benefit right in front of their eyes.
Well, you know, everybody who told me I should talk to you was right. You're a lot of fun. You've got it figured out. I really enjoy your perspective. So I have three questions I always ask my guests, who are worthy of the questions, of course. I know that people are going
to
say, she didn't ask me those questions. Maybe I'm not worthy. I'm just kidding. What's your favorite food, Bill?
Oh, man.
On the spot.
I know. All these questions are tough, because like in terms of food, I'll eat just about anything.
You're a bike racer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, I grew up a poor bike racer, so it didn't matter what you ate as long as you ate. Probably Mexican. I love really good Mexican food, and does cheap beer count?
Sure, of course. That's cheap beer. Yeah, it is a food. It's a whole category by itself. Yeah, it's like bacon. What music do you like to listen to?
Music. I am the quintessential old school guy. I literally still listen to all the same music I listened to growing up, like in high school. And basically that means mostly 80s music, from English music to punk to classic rock and metal. Pretty much anything that came out of the 80s is about what I listen to. New stuff comes on the radio here, like at home, and I'm like, what is that? I have no idea. So I just don't listen to it.
And do you have any pets?
I do. My wife and I have a little dog. Her name is Kayo, and she is a maniac, pretty much. She's a good little dog. We got her, I guess, just about 3 years ago. It was 3 years ago this fall that we got her from a local shelter where actually a good bike racer friend of mine helps out quite a bit. She's been probably one of the more challenging dogs. We've had a lot of shelter dogs and a lot of rescue dogs over the years, and she's probably been one of the more challenging ones, but she's really a good dog at heart. So we have a lot of fun with her.
Well, Bill, it has been a delight to talk with you, and I appreciate you spending so much time with me today. We've been talking with Bill Elliston. You can find out information at ellistoncoaching.com, and there's still a couple spots open on the Belize camp coming up in March. Thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful 2019.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing me on. It's great to speak with you.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. My thanks to Bill Elliston for a delightful conversation. If you're interested in learning more about Bill and his work, you can log on to ellistoncoaching.com. I'd also like to thank Kevin Mills from Rails to Trails. So that's our show for this week. Join me next week for a lengthy chat with the iconic and innovative Tom Ritchie. You're not going to want to miss it. Remember, you can always follow the conversation on Facebook. Leave us a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, or send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without an E. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're staying warm and dry. Stay safe, and in the off chance that it's nice where you are, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.